Really, one would think you've had enough. But not only have you not had enough, but Sukkot is coming. And that's actually what I want to talk about this morning, because I was thinking, if you read, for example, especially the detective stories of the classical era, the English detective stories of the early 20th century, the most famous is Agatha Christie, but there are many others, especially a whole bunch of English writers who wrote the classical detective story. The way that they did it was they would accumulate questions, things that didn't seem to be right, and then at the end, the detective with one answer would solve all the questions. It's a very attractive model. Sometimes it works in Jewish learning too, that the Talmud will ask a whole series of questions and then a rabbi will be able to come up with an answer that solves all the questions. And I realized that a question that I was thinking about this year was in some way solved by the answer that I read to a question that I raised, maybe it was last year or the year before, I don't remember. But I thought what an attractive model it is to pose two questions and then, in the manner of Poirot, Agatha Christie's detective, I can answer them both with the same answer. So first let me give you the questions and then propose an answer. Now, I am not suggesting that this is the answer to these questions. As far as I know, there is no single answer proposed by the tradition, but this one works nicely, and I hope that you'll at least appreciate the way in which it seems to meet many of the problems posed by the questions, even if it's not the definitive answer. So here are the two questions about Sukkot that I want to pose. First of all, the one that I posed a couple of years ago is asked by the Stipler Gaon, who gives the answer that we'll come to in a few minutes. He says, look, the reason you have a sukkah, according to one interpretation, is this was the booth that the Israelites lived in as they were traveling through the wilderness, right? This is an imitation of their temporary huts. But he points out the Talmud also says that a sukkah represents the clouds of glory, anei hakavod, that God covered the Israelites with as they went through the wilderness, so that the sun would not beat down on their heads all day long, because day after day, without sunscreen or presumably hats, they had to walk through the wilderness for 40 years, which is a long time. So he asks the following question. He says, let's say that that's correct, that really what Sukkot commemorates is that God covered the Israelites with clouds as they walked through the wilderness. And therefore, we have a holiday to thank God for covering our ancestors as they walked through the wilderness. He said, this makes no sense. Because don't forget that God did things that were more wonderful and more miraculous than just cover them with clouds. Why don't we have a holiday to celebrate the manna? They walked through the wilderness for 40 years and God made them this miraculous food that tastes like whatever you want, and we have no holiday to celebrate that. Why don't we celebrate how God gave them water in the wilderness? That's more miraculous than a couple clouds. How is it that for 40 years the Israelites wandered through the desert and yet they never died of thirst? Obviously, remember the wells of Miriam? Not only did God provide them with food, but God provided them with water, so it doesn't make any sense that what we would end up celebrating is that God put a few clouds over their head. So that was his question, and I think a pretty good one, which is why in the world would we celebrate what seems to be, on the scale of desert miracles, a fairly minor miracle. Now let's move to a completely different question, but also one about Sukkot, which is, why now? why in the world? First of all, enough with the holidays already. First of all. But why would you celebrate Sukkot now? Because if, in fact, Sukkot celebrates the journey of the Israelites through the wilderness, guess what? They did not do that in the month of Tishrei. Obviously, if you're going to celebrate the Israelites' journey through the wilderness, then Sukkot should come right after Passover. That's when you should have Sukkot. What in the world are we doing celebrating Sukkot? At the time of the creation of the world. That's not when we were liberated from Egypt. That's not when we started to walk through the wilderness. So we have a very serious timing issue. Now, you could say that Sukkot is an agricultural holiday and it has more to do with the agricultural year than it does with going through the desert. But there are two problems with that. First of all, that isn't the way it's justified primarily in the Jewish calendar. Right? It's primarily justified as a holiday that's about going through the wilderness. And second, if you take the agricultural route, then we don't have a question and I can't give you the answer, and there's no sermon. So you're here. So let's assume that it's supposed to celebrate going through the wilderness, which is, by the way, the predominant interpretation. If you ask most people, what do the booths represent? They don't say that the agricultural workers dwelt in the fields as they were collecting the harvest. Instead, they will say, this is what we lived in as we went through the wilderness of Sinai. So, as I said, the Stipler Gaon who asked the first question being, remember, why do we celebrate the clouds of glory and we don't celebrate the manna or the water? It seems to me that if we take his answer, it can answer both questions. He said very beautifully that the reason that we celebrate the clouds is, I don't remember if he put it in exactly these words, but think about a mother, okay? If a mother feeds a baby and gives a baby something to drink, it may be an act of love, but it's also an act of necessity. A mother who doesn't feed her baby is an abusive mother, a terrible mother. You have to do that, right? But a mother who tucks her baby in at night with a blanket is a loving mother. Love is measured by what you don't have to do, by what you do because you love the beloved. You can't say, said the Stipler Gaon, that God loved the Israelites because he gave them food and water. Had God not given them food and water, they all would have died in the wilderness. The measure of God's love is that God put clouds over their head because they would have survived anyway. That was an act of love because that was a gesture of over and above what needed to be done. It was a gesture of comfort. It was a gesture of affection. It was the expression of God's love. So he said, we don't have a holiday to celebrate the manna because without the manna we couldn't have lived. We have a holiday to celebrate the clouds because it's a holiday that celebrates God's love. Beautiful answer. Now think about it in terms of why we have Sukkot after Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur, remember, is all about who will live and who will die. And part of the intent of Yom Kippur is to create anxiety in the worshiper about the sins that we have done and the repentance that we need to do, and we have the Unatana Tokef about who will live and who will die, and we wear white as though the shrouds that we're buried in. It's all about a certain kind of fear for ourselves, and then at the end we blow the shofar and all the fear is supposed to be gone. But we all know that anxiety and fear don't work that way. Again, let's think about a mother and a child. Your kid's supposed to be home at 10. 10:30 comes, still not home. You are filled with anxiety and fear, even though to that callous child, they don't understand it. Finally, when they come home at 11, they're there, they're safe, but your anxiety doesn't disappear. It may be lessened, but it's not as though an anxiety that has built up over a long time disappears just like that. It takes time and it takes reassurance. You have to hear them in their bed. You have to peek in, make sure they're really there. And Sukkot serves the same function. That is, it's an expression of God's love right after a time when we have felt fear and anxiety about God's love. Because now we sit in the Sukkah, and remember, the Sukkah is fragile, but you have to be able to see the stars. You have to be able to see eternity, that which is bright and lasting and beautiful. And so Sukkot is a holiday in which we are reassured, more even than we could be at the end of Yom Kippur with the blowing of the shofar. And maybe that's why the rabbis call Sukkot HaChag, the holiday. Because it is, in many different ways, supposed to be an expression of God's love for Israel and our security in that love. Remember, only somebody who feels secure sits in such a fragile dwelling. If you didn't feel secure, you'd stay in your house. But you feel okay, you feel secure, you feel loved, so you can stay in a temporary place. It's like the beautiful saying in the Talmud. The Talmud has this saying that when we were in love, this is a man and a woman, we could make our bed on the edge of a sword. Now that we have fallen out of love, a bed of 60 cubits is not big enough for us. The same idea. If you feel secure in God's love, you can make your bed in a sukkah. Because inside, you feel all right. So from both of these perspectives, I think that the answer to the question of Sukkot is God's love. And that's why it's supposed to be the time of joy, of such joys, man simchatenu, the time of our joy, even though we sit in a fragile sukkah and are subject to all the elements. Because the elements, of course, are created by God. And so that feels all right. I don't know for sure that this is the answer to the questions that Sukkot raises, but it surely is a powerful theme of the holiday. And it's one of the reasons why, even though we have been through the ringer with Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, people still come back to synagogue to celebrate Sukkot. And I hope you will on Monday morning. Shabbat Shalom.